This is a continuation of reviewing the Rosh on Hilchos Avelos. Baruch Hashem, now I am in a place where I do have a Rosh available, so I have a Rosh in front of me. So we'll continue reviewing mainly from the notes, but you can refer to the Rosh inside if necessary. We were up to Simon Lamed Beis. Simon Lamed Beis discusses the degree of evidence, the degree of testimony which is necessary in order for a person to believe that a death actually took place and to begin mourning. The Maharam adapts the most stringent position. The Maharam seems to say that there might even be a requirement for two kosher valid witnesses, and absent the presence of those witnesses, a person has no right to assume that the reports they've heard about a person's death is true. The Ramban takes perhaps a diametrically opposite position and says that almost all forms of testimony are valid. Even forms of testimony which are not ordinarily accepted in a court of law may be accepted by the Avel in order to begin his mourning. And examples of these other kinds of testimony are the following cases. Number one, an eid echad, a single witness. Ordinarily, a single witness is not credible in a court of law. You need two witnesses. For avelos, though, a single witness is sufficient. Number two, eid mipi eid, a witness who did not observe the death firsthand, but rather heard from a different person who had observed it firsthand. This would not be admissible in a court of law, but would be admissible in order to enable the avel to begin his mourning. Number three, a relative. Not admissible in a court of law because the relative is considered to be somewhat biased in his power of recall. But when it comes to starting avelos, a relative is ne'eman. Number four, if the person, the witness, does not state explicitly that he observed the death, but rather hints at it. In court of law, when testimony must be spelled out explicitly. When it comes to avelos, however, the Ramban brings rayos that even a hint is sufficient. Number five, testimony given by a woman. Ordinarily, in a court of law, this would not be acceptable. See Rabbi Meiselman's book, A Jewish Woman in Jewish Law, for detailed explanation about why this is so. But when it comes to avelos, so the testimony of a woman is acceptable. Number six, question about a guy, a non-Jew, who's mesiach lefitumo, in conversation. He's not intending to testify, but he lets drop in casual conversation that he happens to have observed a person dying. This was very often an extremely important situation or case, because in Europe, when Jews were died in battles or pogroms, etc., very often the only way that we knew that they had passed away was because of testimony of non-Jews who had observed the murder or the death in battle. Very often there were no other Jews who were around at the time to testify about this. More, pressing nafkamina was with regard to the laws of Igun, whether the man's wife may remarry, but there's also the question about, with regard to avelos, whether we can accept this testimony or not. And finally, the last case of a non-standard eidos is when a non-Jew actually appears and with the intention of testifying, not simply of engaging in casual conversation, but he comes to testify that this person died. Can we accept his testimony or not? So the Maharam basically argues that we require a very high standard of credibility, and that many of these cases do not match that standard of credibility. The Ramban, in contrast, argues that we should suffice with a lower standard of credibility because there's a principle which is evoked by the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and the Gemara in Yevamos called Milsa de Avido Le'Igluye, something which will eventually become revealed, something which pretty soon everybody is going to know about. And the Ramban says that there's a principle that nobody will lie about a Milsa de Avido Le'Igluye, because in short order, the truth will become known to all, and then if they were lying, they will be tremendously embarrassed. So in this case, when let's say it's an issue of whether somebody has died or whether somebody has not died, so even if this person, this non-Jew, let's say, is the first person to arrive and say that the person died, if he's really alive, then he may show up, and then the non-Jew will be very embarrassed. So because it'll shortly become clear to everybody that whether or not this death has taken place, clearly no one's going to lie about it. So therefore the Ramban says that that even a guy who has intention of testifying is credible, and the mourner can start testifying based on his words, because it's a milsa d'avida l'igluyei. Furthermore, the Ramban brings a proof and says that we know that when it comes to the laws of aguna, a non-Jew, at least meisiach lifitumo, at least if he's testifying about somebody's death in a conversational manner rather than a testimonial manner, is believed, he's credible. This was one of the takanos that Chazal made in connection or with the cooperation of an assumption that a woman will only get remarried after doing very thorough research. So therefore Chazal said that the formal requirements of Eidos are somewhat relaxed in order to permit an aguna to get remarried, because we assume that, you know, she's going to be so afraid of transgressing the prohibition of adultery. If her husband is alive and she got remarried, she would be considered an adulteress. So we assume that she's so afraid of that that she's going to exert the utmost effort and do research to the nth degree to ascertain that her husband is truly passed away before remarrying. Therefore, we relax the formal requirements up front. We said we can trust her research as long as there is even a guy who is mesiach lefitumo, or maybe a single witness, whatever the precise standards may be, less than ideal testimony. So if people who are not qualified to testify in other circumstances testify that her husband died, so they are credible and she is allowed to get remarried, provided, of course, that she does the research we expect her to do to corroborate the testimony of those witnesses. The Gemara addresses the question of whether she's entitled to her ksuba or not, because we know that any time that a husband passes away, so the woman becomes entitled to collect the money of her ksuba. And whereas aguna is almost like a life and death issue, we're incredibly lenient on the laws of aguna in order to permit agunos to remarry as long as there's room for leniency within the framework of halacha. When it comes to money, there's no reason for us to be so lenient. And so nu, she'll lose out on the couple of $100 or couple of $1,000 that she's supposed to get if she was widowed. But at least she can still get remarried. That's what's really important. However, the Gemara tells us in Yevamos that we're not able to split the credibility of these witnesses. If Chazal believed the witnesses to allow the woman to get remarried, which is allowing her to transgress a potentially serious and severe transgressions of adultery, so certainly the witnesses must be believed with regard to money and allowing her to collect her ksuba, because it would just be like a joke if we were to split the ruling and deem the witnesses credible to allow her to remarry, but deem them not credible with regard to collection of the ksuba. So the same thing holds true, says the Ramban, for Avelos. What type of a joke would it be if we deemed these substandard testimonies credible to allow her to get remarried and transgress a potentially kares prohibition, and deeming them not credible when it comes to Avelos, which may even be simply the Rabbanon. So therefore, says the Ramban, at least in circumstances where these substandard testimonies are also relevant to her getting remarried, we must believe them even with regard to the laws of mourning and to enable her to halachically begin mourning for her husband. And therefore, says Ramban, since we deemed these testimonies credible with regard to mourning for her husband in circumstances where she would otherwise be in aguna, we had to deem them credible in terms of all mourning, because otherwise, once again, we would result in a split halachic ruling wherein, with regard to agunos, such testimonies would be believed. With regard to other people, they wouldn't be believed. But what's the logical reason to deem them credible in this circumstance and not credible in those circumstances? So in order to equalize things, we said that just like these types of testimony are credible when it comes to igun, they're also credible with regard to avelos when no igun is involved. Okay, there's other rayos. I think I spoke about this elsewhere, so I'm not going to elaborate, but that's the basic issue. The Maharam is very stringent and requires higher standards of testimony in order to begin Avelos. The Ramban is rather lenient and suffices with lower standards of testimony in order to begin Avelos, partially on the basis of the logic that that Milsa da Avida le'egluye lo mishakri ba'inshi, people won't lie about something which will eventually be revealed to everybody, and partially based on this textual inference from the laws of Aguna, and partially based on a number of other textual proofs which we're not going to delve into over here. Next, Machlokas, Rosh Simen Lamed Gimel. The question is as follows. If a person hears about the death of a relative on the 30th day after that relative's burial, how are we supposed to treat it? On the one hand, we know that Shmua Krova, a swift report about a relative's death, requires the mourner to observe Shiva and to observe Shloshim. A Shmua Rechoka, a tarrying report, a late report, a distant report, simply requires the mourner to observe a few moments of Avelos. He does not have to observe Shiva and Shloshim. Ordinarily, we say the threshold between a Shmua Krova and a Shmua Rechoka is whether the Shmua arrived within 30 days or whether the Shmua arrived after 30 days. The question is, what if the Shmua arrived, what if this report about the relative's death arrived on day 30? Do we treat it like within the 30 days, or do we treat it like after the 30 days? This dispute is between the Behag and the Rosh. The Behag maintains that we treat it like a Shmua within the 30 days, and therefore the one who hears the report must observe Shiva and Shloshim. And the Rosh says that we treat it like a Shmua which arrives after 30 days, and therefore the relative will only observe a few moments of Avelos. What are some of the issues here? One issue is whether, given that there is no clear textual evidence, do we follow the opinion of the Mekel, of the more lenient position? The Rosh says, well, there isn't any clear evidence that we should be stringent, therefore we should be lenient and allow the Avel, allow the mourner, to observe only a few moments of Avelos and to suffice with that. The Behag brings an interesting proof from a Gemara in Bechoros. The Gemara says that when it comes to a child who Nebuch lo yalenu passes away on the 30th day of his or her life, so we treat it like as if it passed away on the 29th day. So the Behag says clearly this is a proof that day 30 is like day 29. This is a very problematic proof, as the Rosh points out. First of all, we're not talking about a report which arrived on day 30. We're talking about a child who passed away on day 30 of his life. When we say that day 30 is like day 29 in that context, what we mean is that, in general, we mourn for children who were capable of surviving when they were born, but who, due to circumstances, passed away, whereas we do not mourn for children who were incapable of surviving when they were born. And there are two ways of determining whether a child is capable of survival at birth or not. One of them is by surveying their physical characteristic, the appearance of their nails, appearance of their hair, etc. The Chachamim had a way of telling, based on how the nails looked, whether the child was capable of surviving. But a second way is we see if it survives for 30 days, we assume that at birth it was capable of surviving, and therefore if it passes away after day 30, we assume that that was due to circumstances and not due to some inherent defect which was present at birth. So the question is, what happens if the child survives up until day 30 but passes away on day 30? With regard to that, the Gemara tells us that day 30 is like day 29. A child must survive until after day 30 in order for us to assume that it was capable of survival upon birth. If it doesn't survive till the end of day 30, then we assume, just as we would assume if it passed away on day 29, that at birth it was incapable of survival. So that's why we say day 30 is like day 29. To tell you that if a child passes away on day 30, we assume it was incapable of survival at birth unless it demonstrated those physical characteristics which Chazal declared indicate that it was capable of survival at birth. Without those physical characteristics, if it died on day 30, so we would not mourn for it, a formal mourning, because we would assume it was incapable of survival at birth. So that's what the Gemara means when it says day 30 is like day 29. It does not mean that a report which arrived on day 30 is treated like a report which arrived on day 29. They're two totally separate issues, whether the definition of Shmua Krova, the definition of when we assume a child is capable of survival at birth. Very possibly, with regard to the former, we would deem day 30 like day 31, and only with regard to the latter would we deem day 30 like day 29. The Rush brings a proof to his position that one would not observe Avelos when he heard a report of his relative's death on day 30 from the rule of Miktas Hayom Kekulo, that part of the day is considered like the entire day. In other words, on day 30, so we say that as long as the Avel, as long as the mourner observed the laws of Shloshim for a few moments in the morning, the remainder of the day is considered like out of the Shloshim period. Says the Rosh, perhaps we should generalize from here to the laws of a Shmua Krova and Shmua Rechoka. Because the idea of a Shmua Krova is, if the Avel, if the mourner, the relative who ought to be mourning, heard about the death within the time period, which still would require him, still has that degree of bitterness which would require him to observe the laws of mourning, so then we're going to be more stringent. If he heard it after the time passed, when his bitterness following the burial would require mourning of him, so then that's a Shmur Rechoka, and he needs to mourn less. So says the Rosh, because the evening and the late morning of day 30, we assume that the bitterness of death and of burial have already gone away, those are not considered times which are as bitter as the first 30 days, are considered less bitter like day 31 and onwards. So therefore, with regard to Shmua Krova and Shmua Rechoka as well, since the report about the relative's death arrived at a time when the bitterness has already gone down a level, meaning after the first few moments of the morning on day 30, therefore the Avel should not need to observe Shiva and Shloshim, because he already heard about the report at a time when the bitterness of that report is already somewhat muted. So those are some of the proofs. There's another textual proof that the Rosh brings as well. The basic machlokas is Shmua. You hear a report of death on day 30, do we treat it like day 29 and require Shiva and Shloshim? Do we treat it like day 31 and require and suffice with simply a few moments? Simen Lamed Vav. Machlokas between the Bahag and the Rosh again about the following case. What happens if a person is a widower and he has children and he was scheduled to get remarried, and right before the wedding was set to begin, at a time when the deposit is going to be lost and forfeited, should the wedding be cancelled, the father of the chassan or the mother of the kala passes away. Do we say in those circumstances that we delay the burial until after the chuppah and then allow the chassan and kala to have shavu brachos before they observe mourning? Or do we say that no, that these circumstances are different, partly because the chassan already has children and has already therefore fulfilled the mitzvah of Pru Revu, partly because the chassan is no longer considered to be dependent on his father, he already has children, presumably he's already self-sufficient, and therefore he should be able to recoup the loss and pay for another wedding, even if he forfeits his deposit? Indeed, let me take that back, this machlokas is only when there is no financial loss. Only when there's no financial loss. So again, there won't be any financial loss. Do we say that the wedding should go ahead, or that the wedding should be delayed? So the Bahag says that the wedding should go ahead they should have their chuppah, but then they should observe Shiva before observing Shava Brachos. The Rosh asks, what's the purpose of having a chuppah in the wedding earlier if they're not going to observe Shava Brachos until after the Shiva anyhow? You may as well observe the Shiva and postpone the wedding so that it arrives right before the Shava Brachos. That's the opinion of the Rosh. Again, I don't have here in my notes any proofs one way or another. This case is somewhat idiosyncratic. It differs from the classical case of the Gemara in many ways. Number one, that we're talking about a case where it's not going to cause any monetary loss to postpone the wedding. Number two, we're talking about a case where the chassan already has children, so there is no critical demand of rushing ahead with the wedding and the Shavuot Brachos on account of the mitzvah of procreation. And as we said, we're talking about a case where the involvement of the chassan's father is perhaps less than it would be in other circumstances because the chassan is already self-sufficient. Therefore, the Rosh says that they should observe Shiva and postpone even the chuppah until later on. And the Bahag says that no, that this still sufficiently resembles the classical case wherein we would go ahead with the chuppah. And therefore, in this case also, we should go ahead with the chuppah, even though it seems, as the Rosh points out, that we are not really gaining anything by marrying this couple off before the Shiva. What about in the classical case? In the classical case where the chassan does not have children, where he still is dependent upon his father, and where, following the father's death, there's going to be an irrecoverable loss of the deposit that was put down for the wedding feast. So the Gemara in Ksubos tells us that we go ahead with the wedding and with the Shava Brachos, however, that because of the fact that there's an avelos in abeyance, the chassan and the kala are not permitted to have yichud. They're not permitted to be together alone. So the Rosh and the Ravid have two disputes about the scope of this prohibition of yichud. Dispute number one concerns whether the prohibition applies by day or whether it only applies at night. The Ravid says that the prohibition only applies at night, and that during the day the prohibition does not apply. Not only that, says the Ravid, but the chassan and kala are permitted to have affectionate contact. They're allowed to have chibuk v'nishuk during the day. During the day they can even hug and kiss, but during the night they can't even be together alone in the same room. The Rosh, in contrast, says that the prohibition applies both by day and by night. That's one dispute between the Ravid and the Rosh. A second dispute concerns what does it mean for them to be alone. The Ravid says that there must be men accompanying the chassan and women accompanying the kala. It's more stringent than an ordinary yichud prohibition, where you could say that with two extra women or whatever the number is, extra men, extra women, the prohibition goes away. In this case, says the Ravid, the chassan must sleep in a men's dormitory, the kala must sleep in a women's dormitory. An ordinary number of only men or only women, which would be sufficient to dispel the prohibition of yichud, is insufficient in this circumstance because we are worried that the chassan and kala will have such a strong yetzer hara to consummate their marriage that they're going to dodge their guardians and get out of it, so we need more guardians. That's what the Ravid says. And the Rosh says, and know that the definition of yichud, of seclusion, when it comes to this case, is the same definition as when it comes to all other cases of yichud, and suffices with just the sufficient number of men or the sufficient number of women to dissolve the status of seclusion under ordinary circumstances. What are some of the proofs? The Ravid says that the Gemara in Ksubos, which discusses these circumstances, talks about Hu Yoshev Bein HaAnashim Behi Yosheves Bein HaNashim. That would seem to indicate that the man must be guarded by men, and the woman must be guarded by women, and it's insufficient to have members of one gender guarding the both of them together, because then they'll be able to dodge it. And the Rosh says that expression is lav dafka, it's not meant to be taken literally, but it simply means that they're not supposed to be secluded, and obviously the logical place for them to go is back to their yeshiva dormitory or cemetery or seminary dormitory. That's probably where they're going to go, but not that they're obligated to go there. Technically, they can go together back to their apartment as long as they have a little boy or some people guarding over them to make sure that they do not consummate their marriage. The Rosh also cites a position which he disagrees with, that if a couple is in Avelos during a Yontif, such as if a mace, a close relative of one of them, died on Yontif itself, that and was buried on Yontif itself, and therefore the Avelos is held in abeyance until after Yontif, that under those circumstances they are forbidden from being secluded together. This is an opinion that the Rosh brings down. He says basically it's the same as if the Avelos was held in abeyance on account of a chasana, on account of Sheva Brachos. Just like we assume that an Avelos which is held in abeyance on account of Sheva Brachos, that because Chazal were so lenient to allow the Avelos to be postponed, therefore they had to institute a stringency and prohibit the couple from being in seclusion, lest they think that this is a lenient Avelos and perhaps come to transgress some of the prohibitions of Avelos. So too, when the Avelos is postponed on account of a Yontif, because of this leniency of postponing the Avelos, perhaps there should be a requirement to compensate by being extra stringent and forbidding the couple from being in seclusion together. However, the Rosh disagrees with this comparison. He says that, first of all, there are additional leniencies when it comes to Sheva Brachos, when it comes to marriage. It's not simply the leniency of holding the Avelos in abeyance, but we actually delay the burial of the deceased until after the Chuppah. That is a much larger leniency than simply delaying the start and the outset of practicing and observing Avelos. So there we need to compensate for that extra leniency. But on a regel, on a holiday, when we don't have that extra leniency because we permit burial on Chol HaMoed, and simply the observance of Shiva, which we delay, there's no need to compensate. Moreover, says the Rosh, at a chasana, there's even greater joy than there is during the Mo'adim. There's even greater joy at a chasana than on a holiday. And therefore, we're worried that that extra level of joy will go to the heads of the chasana and the kala and lead them, perhaps, to consummate their marriage in violation of the laws of Avelos. However, on Yontif, there is a very high level of joy, but not as high as the joy of a chasana, and therefore, we would not require an additional level of stringency to prohibit them from being in seclusion. There's other proofs also. These are some of the critical disputes that focus around Avelos and Simcha. These questions about the scope of the prohibition of seclusion, whether it requires extra guarding, not extra guarding, whether it applies by night or also by day, and whether you can compare a holiday to Sheva Brachos. Another discussion here comes up about ritual immersion, tevila b'mikvah, during Avelos. This is in the Rosh Simen Lamed Zayin. In Simon Lamed Zayin, the Gaonim are reported as saying that a woman who's in mourning may be tovel in a mikvah for her nidos because of the rule that tevila bismana is a mitzvah. It's a positive commandment for her to immerse in the mikvah at the right time, and therefore, even though it's during Shiva, in order to fulfill this mitzvah, Chazal were relaxed the prohibitions against bathing and showering during Shiva in order for her to fulfill this mitzvah of immersing at the right time. Rabbeinu Tam, however, maintains that immersion at the right time nowadays is not a mitzvah. First of all, because its telos perhaps cannot be realized, because ordinarily immersion at the right time is a mitzvah because of taharos, because a person who goes around in a state of ritual impurity is not permitted to touch things which are tahar, food, etc., truma, and moreover, such a person poses a risk of defiling and rendering impure all of the sanctified types of food that people use to eat all the time in Eretz Yisrael. The truma, the challah, the karbanos, etc. So therefore, tefillah bizmana was a mitzvah. Nowadays, everyone assumes that they're ritually impure anyhow. So you're not going to gain anything by immersing to remove the impurity of nidos or the impurity of ziva, because anyhow, we don't have truma and karbanos, etc. Or at least, even if we did have the little bits that we do have, we are no better because we're tummy anyhow with tumas meis, which we can't get rid of for other reasons also. There's a big general nafkamina, which is if you say that tefillah bizmana mitzvah, then a woman who is uncertain about when she's supposed to immerse must immerse at every single possible opportunity, or every single time when there's a possibility that she's obligated to immerse. Rabbeinu Tam says, however, that we rule that even a woman who's uncertain about when she must immerse needs only to immerse once at the moment when she's certain that she's ritually pure. She does not have to immerse at every single turn when she might have become ritually pure. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Tam, that is a proof that tevila bizmana eina mitzvah. The fact that we don't require her to just do an act of immersion every time that it may be obligated, and we simply allow her to suffice with one act of immersion once she's certain that she's rich, that she's ready to become ritually pure, that indicates that tefillah bizmana is not a mitzvah. Rather, it's simply something which enables her to transfer from a state of impurity to purity, but it's not a fulfillment of a positive obligation. Simin lamites. What happens if a person passes away on Erev Yontif and time is running out? The relatives realize that there's not enough time for them to bury their deceased relative on their own, because were they to do so, they would end up violating Yontif. So therefore, they hire a Gentile undertaker to complete, or to begin even, the burial process on Yom Tov. And then the relatives go home and prepare for Yontif. So the question is, what do they do with regard to mourning? Do we say that they begin their mourning for a few moments on Erev Yontif, and then the Yontif comes and totally wipes away their requirement to observe Shiva? Or do we say that no, that because the burial itself took place on Yontif, therefore the Shiva was not scheduled to begin until Yontif itself, and it's held in abeyance, and it begins then on Motzai Yontif, on the day after Yontif? So the Behag maintained that they begin mourning right away because of a rule that when the corpse is given to undertakers and people turn their face away from the coffin, so they begin mourning right away, regardless of when the burial is going to take place. Therefore, the Behag says, in this case as well, once they've given the coffin to the undertakers and turned their faces away, they have a halachic obligation to begin mourning, to begin Shiva. Once they began Shiva before Yontif, so Yontif comes and interrupts the Shiva, and they're not obligated to continue the Shiva after Yontif. That's the position of the Behag. The Ramban, however, differentiates between this case and an ordinary case of giving a coffin to Gentile undertakers. The Ramban says that in an ordinary case, when one hands over a coffin to Gentile undertakers, so he basically assumes that he will have nothing more to do with this burial. He assumes he's not going to be able to escort the coffin anywhere. He's not going to be present for the burial, etc. In this case, however, because why? Because the undertakers usually, when you give over to the undertakers, it's because you're incapable of going any further on your own, of accompanying the coffin on your own, and therefore you give it to the undertakers to take it for the remainder of the journey. And when a person usually gives over the coffin to the undertakers, it signifies that their involvement in the burial, their involvement in accompanying the coffin, is at an end, and that is why they're allowed to begin avelos. It's not simply the formal, you know, action of giving the coffin over, but rather it is the decision to leave, to abandon, so to speak, the coffin and the deceased, and to turn back and to begin mourning. That's what causes the mourning to begin. However, in this case, where the relatives basically have a prohibition against doing the actual act of burial on account of malacha on Yom Tov, however, there's no prohibition of escorting the coffin and of visiting the cemetery and watching the burial, so therefore the relatives have not actually given over and totally distanced themselves from the coffin and from the burial. They simply have delegated some of the activities which they're incapable of doing to other people. Imagine if you arrive at a cemetery and you just, it's difficult physical labor to dig the grave and to cover it up. So let's say that you ask the undertaker to take care of the burial, of actually shoveling the dirt. So over there, we don't say that just because you're asking the undertaker to shovel the dirt that avelos begins, because you're no longer doing any action to be involved in the burial. The avelos only begins when you actually turn away and leave the cemetery and leave the grave. So the same thing over here, just because you're asking the undertakers to do the physical labor which is prohibited on Yontif does not mean that you have abandoned the mace, and therefore avelos does not start. So if the relatives did not abandon the mace until after Yom Tov began, so avelos never began before Yontif, and therefore they're obligated to observe Shiva after Yontif ends. The Rambam says it really should depend, therefore. It's not across the board, says the Rambam. The Ramban says that across the board, avelos is pushed off until after Yontif. The Rambam says it depends. If you know when the burial took place, did it end up taking place before Yontif? Did it take place on Yontif? If you know when it took place, so then possibly you should delay the avelos until after Yontif. If you did not know when the burial took place, in other words, Yutaka did abandon the coffin when you gave it over to the undertakers, so then the avelos should begin as soon as the undertakers took charge of the coffin. Another machlokes, the Gemara talks about avelos beginning from the time that the golel is closed. A golel is an ambiguous term. What exactly does it mean? Rashi says that it means the cover of the coffin. Rabbeinu Tam in Tosfos says that it means the stone which ordinarily was placed atop a freshly dug grave. Nafkamina, whether avelos begins from when the coffin is covered or from when the stone is placed atop the grave. Now, this is a major nafkamina, not only in cases where the coffin was covered on one day and the stone was placed atop the grave on a different day, not only for whether the mourners are obligated to observe the laws of avelos in between the time when the cover is placed on the coffin and when the stone is placed atop the grave, but another potential nafkamina is for a kohen, because a kohen is only allowed to become tamei to his deceased relative before the golel is closed. If it's the earlier stage, meaning when the coffin is closed, it means that at every point after the coffin is covered, a kohen must take care not to become tamei even to this deceased relative. If it's a later stage of placing a stone atop the grave, then the kohen would be permitted to help carry the coffin to the cemetery, to bury it, etc. And until the last moment, the kohen will be permitted to make himself tamei to his relative. So Rashi seems to be a more stringent opinion. Rabbeinu Tam seems to be a more lenient opinion. What are some of the proofs? So first of all, Rabbeinu Tam says that there's a good discussion in the Gemara about using an animal as a golel. So if it means the cover of a coffin, it would be very strange to use a live sheep or a live goat to cover up a coffin. It's just very, very difficult case to imagine, perhaps even a humorous case to imagine. However, if it means the stone atop the grave just to mark where the grave is, because sometimes you can lose the place, so you need to mark it until you have time to put up a permanent marker. So under those circumstances, sometimes people would just tie an animal to the spat to mark where the grave is, and that's more easy to imagine. So that's one proof for Rabbeinu Tam that a golel means the stone atop the grave, because you wouldn't use a live animal to cover up the coffin. Moreover, says Rabbeinu Tam, it's inconceivable that the Kohen should not be permitted to escort the coffin to the cemetery once it's been covered. Therefore, it must mean the golel must be referring to the stone atop the grave. That way the Kohen is able to make himself impure even up until that stage. Those are two proofs that Rabbeinu Tam brings. He brings other proofs as well. What else appears in the Rosh and Siman Lamed Tes? Question about whether a person is allowed to uncover the body or not. Meaning, once the coffin has been buried, let's say that another relative arrives and wants to see the coffin, he wants to kiss the corpse goodbye or whatever else it is. Are you allowed to uncover the grave during the first 3 days of mourning or not? The Rosh brings down two opinions about this, about whether it's permitted to uncover the coffin during those first days or whether it is not permitted. I think that for now we'll stop again, take another break, and we'll pick up with the Rosh and Siman Mem Beis.